it was one of the books that was most eagerly anticipated in the fall. And, you know, if you listen to this show, you know, Stephen and myself, we've talked an awful lot about, you know, the concern, the focus now on brain injuries in sports. But this book, Game Change, by Ken Dryden, The Life and Death of Steve Mondador and the Future of Hockey. I got to say, we're pleased to welcome Ken Dryden in studio. I'm going to say, this kind of caught a lot of people off guard, didn't it? Do you get the sense that this book that this book caught people off guard, hockey people off guard?
I think you might know better than I do. I'm not sure that a lot of people knew I was writing it. I didn't broadcast that I was. I was... I think that if they knew I was writing it, I think they may have been surprised by, you know, the depth of writing a story about a player. And then I think some of them were quite surprised by the thread of the story of a game, and that I felt as if the only way you can understand concussions is first of all through an individual and how life affecting it is. But then the second part is in terms of, okay, let's put this into the context of a game. What really is this game as opposed to what we say it is, what we think it is, what we know in our know it is because we heard it and we experienced it. But what is it like actually now that we see on the screen? And so I think maybe some people were surprised by that.
Mm. When Mondador died, you know, I think he was lumped in some people's heads with there were several hockey players who died young, right? And Dirk Bogarde and Rip and a bunch of guys, and he was kind of Wade Belak, right? That he was kind of, yeah, and he was a part of that list. But I wonder why his story was the one you chose to tell.
Well, in part because. He really wasn't the same kind of player as those the players that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. I mean, he fought, but he wasn't a fighter. Right. And I didn't want to write about a fighter or a goon. I mean, it's too specific a story. It's too unique a story. And I didn't want to write about a superstar, you know, and a diminished career of Eric Lindros or Paul Kariya, because somehow it's too much about the superstar. I wanted to write about somebody who was pretty much like every player. And I mean, he was different in that he was a 5-6 defenseman. He wasn't a 1-2 defenseman, but had the same kind of attitude, approach, you know, place in the game, you know, was at the core of the team, loved to be a part of the team, loved to be counted on, loved to count on the team. You know, just that somebody reading about Steve or hearing about him would say, geez, that's not much different from me or from my kid, so that his story might connect and resonate.
So he has a more chance to be a universal here, right?
I think so. That's what I'm hoping, and that's why I chose to write about Steve.
You know, what I found, I don't know if I'd use the word poignant necessarily, but the notes that he kept, the notebook he kept, and I'm looking at it right now. I'm a note keeper. I write notes about everything. I'm single-handedly keeping Moleskin in business. That's just that's the way I am, and I've always been that way. But when you read this, you're getting an insight into an individual who seems to be trying to talk himself through some of the most basic things. You know, I'm looking at this. You know, you talk about in subsequent game days, he noted other things that might seem too small to matter. Right. I brought food drinks for a homeless guy yesterday. I left tickets for Oscar the Barber. I held a door for a lady at the rink. Like, and that is kind of chilling because part of me, when I read that, it's almost like he's trying to remind himself as well.
Yes.
Of what he's done.
Yes, I think so. But the other part of it, and it's something that he believed and he would tell people, but he absolutely believed it, is that anything that you do can change the world. That's what and so you know, you hold the door for a woman, you know, it makes her smile. And it makes her smile, and then, you know, the next person that she sees, she has a certain different attitude, you know, about it. And then that person and then the next person. And that's what he believed. I mean, I remember one of his friends talking about, you know, saying he would even talk to the toll collector on a freeway. I mean, nobody talks to the toll collector. And he would think, you know, what an awful job. You're there, you're greeting, you know, 10,000 people a day, and you don't have any interaction with any of them.
We're not talking about a meathead here, are we?
No, not at all. I mean, he was somebody who was just, he was interested in life. I mean, he would do all kinds of different things, and he just figured that whatever it is you do can have an impact, so why not do it?
You know, one of the things, you know, I was really interested in your approach, Ken, because you tell the Montador story, and it's a really sad, it's a horribly sad story about a guy who was, you know, broken, and his life was diminished by the game he played, by the injuries he suffered, by brain injuries. And, you know, we can get into the science of that and, you know, the dotted lines versus the solid lines and the causal, how causal it may or may not be. You know, there's, you know, I don't think there's much debate, but there is some debate in some places. But the second part of the book, or the last part of the book, you know, like, I think, you know, John Branch wrote a great book about Derek Bogart. It's a terrific book and a different kind of player. And it's the sad cautionary tale of Derek Bogart. And at the end of it, you go, boy, that's an awful story. And I'm not sure what we can do about it, though, because hockey's dangerous and people get hurt and people's lives go off the rails for all kinds of different reasons. The last part of this book is prescriptive. And that's and that's really interesting to me, that you say, no, we can do something about it. And here's what we should do about it. And, you know, you very directly point your finger. You know, Gary Bettman's name is repeated over and over and over again like a mantra in the last section of this book, saying, you, Gary Bettman. Now, you know, he is an employee of the owners. He runs the league. You know, he's not the god of hockey, but he's certainly the most powerful man in hockey. And he also, you know, the owners negotiate a collective agreement with the players' union, you know, which has some power, and the players have some power over their own lives as well. But I just want to... the idea that you would not just tell this sad story and then let people draw their own conclusions. You say, no. There's a conclusion to be drawn here, and here's what it is.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, that like you and like, you know, others, I mean, that I have a great belief in awareness. People love to talk about awareness. Whatever it is you end up doing, if they say, well, you brought greater awareness, isn't that great? Well, it's great to a point. But beyond awareness is that it's the next step. Mm. It's applying the awareness. And the assumption is, and journalists believe it, scientists believe it, citizens believe it, is that if you create enough awareness, that the next step will be automatic. It is not automatic. And we see it again and again and again in any of our big public questions, and whether it's climate change or inequality or whatever it is, more and more awareness. And if something doesn't happen, then the assumption is that the answer is greater awareness, and greater awareness still. No, it isn't. It is still up to the decision maker. And the decision maker has to decide to apply that awareness, and not just in a way that is sort of conveniently applied and easily applied, but is consistent with the dimensions of the problem that one becomes aware of through this awareness.
I would say that you're probably one of the few people who could do that. If I wrote this book and I set out something prescriptive, but because of your position as a former player, a politician, you know, a well-known spokesman, I mean, I was going to say an activist, but somebody with a pretty clear worldview. Did you almost feel when you did you go into this book thinking you were going to finish it that way, or did you go into this book thinking I'm going to tell this story, and then sort of halfway through go, oh, you know what, I've got to take this further.
I started it with what I knew I was going to get into the
okay.
end. To me, there was no purpose whatsoever in reading the preamble. And of just generating awareness. Done that. You know, there are limits to it. I've written the articles. Yeah. I like writing articles. I got access to the you know, the best media to write those articles. You get to a certain point. Nope, it's not happening. And so what is the point of the next one? And so this is all about decision making. And because it is, then it's like, okay, who is the decision maker? And yes, there are all kinds of entities. I mean, there is the National Hockey League. There's the Board of Governors. There's the owners. There's the Players Association. There's the International Ice Hockey Federation. There's Hockey Canada. There's the USA Hockey and provincial associations and the rest of it. But guess what? After 24 years, and I'm sure it wasn't his intention when he started, there is one singular decision maker in hockey, and that is Gary Bettman. And since he and they won the lockout in 2004-05 and got the salary cap, that it is undeniably Gary Bettman, which is the challenge, but it's also, I think, the most promising part of it.
Right.
I mean, would I write this the same way if Roger Goodell, was? No, I wouldn't. I don't think Roger Goodell has the authority, one, and I don't think he has the capacity or the instinct or the intelligence or the experience to do this. I think Gary Bettman has all of these things. And as you guys talk about, I mean, that hockey is a much, much, much more fixable game. Right. Than football.
Well, because you don't present a manifesto at the end. You don't present a 30-point plan
right.
for fixing hockey. You present a 2-point plan. It's dead simple, right? Yeah. No headshots, no finishing checks.
Right.
And I know some people say, well, you can't, that's not going to be hockey. But I think we probably have to get past that discussion, don't we?
Absolutely. And the thing that is so interesting, and some of this is in the book, but some of it is in just the last couple of months since the book has been out and traveling around, but also watching games on television. And it's really interesting how this game almost since last year, I mean, it may be since a couple of years, but this game is getting better and better and better, more and more skilled. The movement of the puck is almost breathtaking. I mean, on the stick, it's always on the stick. Guys going into open ice, the puck is there, the pace picks up, the shots around the net, there's almost no space to hit anything. They put it into that spot. I mean, it's as if what has happened is that for all of the years of hockey, which we all knew was the fastest game in the world, but, we know what happens when you pick up speed, you become clumsy and other things. I mean, it was going too fast for our minds. It was going too fast for our sticks and hands and the rest of it. I think in the last couple of years, and especially even in the last year, that the hands have caught up and the mind has caught up and the creativeness have all caught up with the speed that is there. And we're seeing for the first time all of this come together and seeing what that is.
Sorry, go ahead. No, I was just going to say, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. The goon is gone. Staged fighting, pretty much gone. We had Doug McLean on this morning. We're talking about the concept of home ice advantage. He said, well, I don't know what it is now, because in the old days it used to be send Probert out on the ice, and that would be home ice advantage. A couple of years ago, I remember Dion Phaneuf talking about how he consciously had changed the way he hit players. He was not driving guys into the end boards anymore. I mean, I would argue that there has been some change. But I don't know, Ken, can you legislate against, I turn the wrong way,
yes,
and boom,
yeah,
I hit somebody in
absolutely.
The head?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is, we do that already.
Okay.
I mean, and we do it already, like, in a couple of things. That's why, again, I wrote it in a way where this isn't revolutionary thinking. If it's revolutionary, then everybody gets, it's like, oh, it's too much of a leap. This is all incremental evolutionary. And so we started back, probably, in the first decades of hockey, where we said the head's vulnerable, so we're going to create a high-sticking penalty, we're going to create an elbowing penalty.
Yep.
We've had them for a century or more, however long it happens to be. One of the other things that we have done in the last couple of years, we've created automatic penalties for certain things. Shoot the puck over the boards, into the crowd, from your defensive zone, automatic penalty. What happened first? Big debate. Dumb penalty, didn't intend it, glass is short in this arena, the ice is bad. About 2 weeks later, no debates. You go right to the box, no big deal. Teams adapt, coaches adapt.
Face-off rules this year.
Yeah. Well, face-off rules. The other one, stick to the face. Stick to the face, automatic penalty. If he's cut, 4 minutes or worse than that. Again, all kinds of debates. And then eventually not. Teams adapt. Coaches adapt. Players adapt. The game goes on. This year, the big thing about slashing. you know, that oh man, you're calling everything a slashing, you're ruining the game, I was only tapping this and that. Players adapt, no big deal. You get on with it. The thing about hits to the head is that, and that we're starting, we haven't quite figured that out, is that an elbow to the head, a stick to the head, you know, or anything else to the head, the brain doesn't distinguish whether it's legal or illegal.
Right.
It doesn't distinguish between a shoulder and an elbow. And all you need to do is just simply say, it's about the effect, not the cause, and we'll deal with the cause. Teams deal with it all the time. Mm. Players deal with it all the time. These, and I tried to get into it in the book, we're comparing it to the dead parrot sketch with Monty Python.
Right.
But we get into these day after debates of, was the head down a little bit? Was it up a little bit? Yeah. Was it targeted? Was it not targeted? Was it this or that? It doesn't matter. You know, whether it's legal, illegal, what, you know, head down, head up. And the other thing that is, and it goes to the fact of how this game is changing, is that how many times do these really happen in the course of a game anyway now? Watch the next game with that in mind. It's not very often.
Right.
I mean, that in fact, it doesn't represent changing a heck of a lot in order to have a significant impact.
Go ahead.
We've only got 3 minutes, unfortunately, because we're up against a hard break. Yeah. Go ahead.
I wonder,
Steve,
what you say to people who, you know, who think that the game, and I look, there's obviously safety concerns and hedge up. Something like finishing a check, where people say the game, the physicality of the game, you know, people forget how savage this game used to be. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just thinking as you're talking about that, you know, Wayne Mackey and Ted Green hitting each other over their unhelmeted heads with hockey sticks.
That's right.
Right? We saw that used to happen. This game now is tame compared to what it used to be. And there's, you know, there would be people who would sit here and say, well, if you take away finishing checks, what is it?
Right.
Is it ringette? What is it?
But the team part that hasn't gone away and that has increased is the force of the body. The stick is almost, it used to be the cautionary tale. You'd say, well, we have to have fighting because the alternative is a stick and it's more dangerous than, you know, than a fist is. What's happened since is a couple of things. One is that the sticks aren't lumber anymore. They weigh almost nothing, and so they're less of a weapon than they used to be. The second part is that we now helmet the head.
Yeah.
And so a stick to the head isn't that much of a big deal. A body to the head is a big deal.
Yeah.
That's where the big change comes. And just, if I can, just
yeah,
one last
go ahead.
Yeah,
yes,
go ahead.
Is kids emulate what they see on television. What do they see now? They don't watch the game so much. They watch the highlights the next morning. They watch YouTube to see the highlights. What do they see on the highlights? And I've tested it out the last two Sundays after 11 games, one Saturday night and 12 another. They see sort of one big hit. There was one fight, one injury, a couple of saves, and 25-plus goals.
Yeah.
And you know what they're going to do right after they watch that, when they go to practice, when they go to games, and in between times, they are imagining this unbelievably creative move that they are going to come up with. The game has already passed by the understandings that we still have of what this game is supposed to be. All I'm suggesting is don't know anymore. See. Just see what is out there and then adapt to what we see.
The book is fantastic. It's called Game Change, The Life and Death of Steve Montador and the Future of Hockey. It's by Ken Dryden, as we said. It's not just a narrative. There's a, as Mr. Brunt pointed out, a fairly easy prescription here. Deb, I'll ask you, have you heard back from Gary Bettman about this?
We'll say that we've had a couple of short emails, and there will be a time.